Well may we say, God save the Queen, because nothing will save the Governor General.
You know I've searched my heart to prove there's better ways to push and pull. Hey, whatever gets you through these days.
Hello and welcome to Well May We Say, a progressive podcast about Australian politics. This is episode 22 for Friday, 19th of May, 2017. I'm Jeremy Sear, and each week I'll be joined by a different guest host to help me look into what's happening to our country and why, what's going to happen and what we can do about it. Tonight's guest host is Greg Jericho from The Guardian. Hi, Greg. Welcome back.
Hello. Good to be here.
You're there. What's your official title at The Guardian these days?
I don't know what my official title is. I think I'm... I don't know if I've even got one. What do they call me online? Blogger for economics and politics, I think.
So you're...
columnist.
People don't know who Greg is. It's no longer, I suppose, the way to introduce you by saying you're, you know, at Grogs Gamut on Twitter and the Grogs Gamut blog and so forth, because your prominence as a Guardian writer is probably a bit higher now.
So
it's probably the more relevant way to introduce you. So look, I have in fact heard you do a podcast about the budget since it came out, because you're on the Guardian one. But that was, I think, only a day or so.
It was that night. It was about 10 o'clock on budget night. Lenore Taylor and Catherine Murphy and I went in the booth and let forth our ramblings.
I think you're all being a bit cagey at that point too, in terms of your views about, because I know that at that point the narrative of this is a Labor light budget had been established. But is that still your view? If it was your view, now it's about a week ago and a lot's happened since then.
Yeah, I mean my view was that it was Labor light. It was the Liberal Party's attempt to what it thought would be Labor light. And it is Labor light so long as you ignore various things.
$65 billion of company tax cuts and kicking the poor in the face and
and one of the reasons why I think on the day it had the Labor light label attached to it was because a lot of the, I guess, less laboristic aspects had already been dropped. Like one of the biggest cuts in the budget were cuts to the family tax benefit, or, you know, they froze the indexation. Now that was announced back in March, so it was kind of, that had been forgotten. The education...
hang on. I didn't even know about that. Okay, so this is seconds away from me having a family. God damn it, that is exactly what would happen. Right, okay, so that's been... And then the university...
Yeah, and the university cuts had already been announced the week before. So on the day, what was announced was one, the increase in the Medicare levy and in the bank levy. So everyone's like, oh, that's, you know, Labor light, you know, they're raising taxes. And it is a Labor-esque budget, I guess, if you focus on the big numbers in revenue and expenditure, in the sense that they're raising revenue. And I think...
And if they've remembered that revenue is a part of the equation, opposed to the last 3 years where they pretended it doesn't exist.
Yeah, and I think that's the... One of the things on budget day when you're in the lockup, you're frantically trying almost not to miss anything major, and you're trying to get a sense of what this massive thing is, and you'll often have people like in the Guardian. There's about a dozen of us in there, and there'll be some people who are focusing on the welfare aspects. Some are looking at education and health. Some are looking at defence, and because you really don't have enough time to look at all of them, there's a few of us who, and I'm kind of one of them who's trying to get a bit of the overall sense, but my main thing is to look at those big numbers to see what's happening with revenue and expenditure and especially on the revenue side, to see whether it actually makes sense and whether the numbers are dodgy or not.
Are they dodgy? Because they feel... Well, there's an awful lot of this horrible, was it commercial incompetence stuff that's just, what do they market as? Not for NFP, not for publication. They say, oh, the figures for this $8 billion we're going to spend on inland freight to pander to the National Party so that they can transport grain. But none of the, we're going to give that to the Australian Rail Track Corporation, and then we're going to just market NFP as to how that money is, where that money is going, how it's being spent, because it's all commercial incompetence. Like, that isn't every time those words commercial incompetence, it just seems so shonky.
I'm not too... A lot of that type of spending, the Inland Rail and even the, you know, the Sydney Airport, the second airport, what they've mostly done with that is put it in the wonderful off-budget pile, because they're often they're not actually spending it so much as they're investing in it. They're actually investing in equity, so they'll be partners and they'll have a stake in something that they can then sell, and they believe they can sell at a return. So as a result, it's put off budget, so that doesn't affect too much the figures, really. I mean, you could where there is a bit more of a concern is the bank levy actually going to raise what they say it's going to raise?
So what's that? That's like point. What was it? 0.06% on a levy on their borrowings. How does that work?
It's not actually on their borrowings. I'll just get the and just as a nice little shout out to Treasury. Your budget papers are crap.
it feels like they're deliberately obtuse.
More just how they're doing. In the past, it always used to be web pages, and you could just easily go from portfolio to portfolio. You could just click on Treasury and bring up all the cuts and expenditures to Treasury. Now it's all just PDF files for the entire thing, and it makes it bloody annoying. And they've only started doing it the last couple of years. It's almost like Morrison must have... had a bit of a say in it.
You don't think that they want to make it as difficult as possible for people to check their numbers?
Yeah, well, it's also annoying, just a real insider baseball kind of thing. It's actually annoying in the lockup. You get all the papers, which are obviously in paper form, which is not real useful for someone like me who needs all the figures in spreadsheets and so forth. And they do give you a thumb drive, which actually you think, great, we've got a thumb drive, so it's all digital. But the thumb drive is just of PDF files, and the tables in the PDF are locked, so you can't copy and paste them onto a spreadsheet.
What? Why? What is their excuse?
I have no idea. It is that they don't have any... So a lot of that data on there having to input, you know, manually, which is just absurd. Basically, the levy is, to get back to the question, it's 0.015% of the bank's license liabilities, which is not quite their borrowings, but, you know, their corporate bonds, commercial papers, certificates, deposits, capital instruments, and various things. And just exactly how it will be done is not quite clear, and certainly the banks in there, and you always have to take a bit of grain of salt, because they're certainly playing the lobby card very hard at the moment. But they're suggesting that Treasury haven't got it quite clear exactly how it's going to be levied.
And when they do, the banks will have teams to try and avoid it.
Oh, yeah.
Not that that's a reason not to do it.
Yeah, because you know, it's all very well to say, oh, you'll be... it'll be levied on X, Y, and Z, but as you know, if you're dealing with taxes and things like this, the language has to be very specific, because there will be lawyers, certainly in the banks, doing all they can to move things out of the taxable range to make their liability as small as possible. So, but essentially in the budget papers, as you're right, it's 0.015% of their liabilities now. They're suggesting that it's going to raise $6.2 billion over 4 years.
How optimistic do you think those assumptions are?
Well, it's one of those things where it's such a niche area. I'm not real sure whether, you know, I think Ken Henry, while he certainly has a vested interest in this, I do agree with him that I'd like to see the methodology behind how they came up with those numbers. That at least with the...
Hang on. They haven't shown their workings?
No, not that I'm aware of.
Well, how's that got any credibility at all? How do they put that stuff out there and then just go, just trust us? It's not like we'd bullshit you. How can they get away with not showing how they get there?
Well, because they don't have to... you know, it's the same with the Medicare levy. They don't... they just put the figures there. They don't actually need to provide the evidence that those figures are correct.
But we as the public are trusting the financial... we're trusting financial journos are able to tell us if the numbers the government's using are bullshit. So but what you're saying is that nobody knows. So basically, no, financial journos are basically getting...
Yeah.
But how's that acceptable? Basically, why aren't we all hollering at the government saying, we don't believe you until you give us the basis on which you're making those claims? You've never earned the benefit of the doubt. Why should we believe your numbers? Like, there's that. There's the assumption they're making on this one, isn't it, that they're somehow going to get back to surplus through magical growth from the company tax cuts.
At least with the company tax cuts, when they introduced those, they did actually introduce the modelling behind it. But again, it wasn't the modelling for the actual cost in terms of revenue or perhaps increased revenue down the track. It was all about changes to economic growth. And that's what Treasury will do occasionally. When they're introducing something major, they will release the modelling on what they think the impact of this will have on economic growth. But what you don't really see is how do they actually come up with that precise figure of $6.2 billion in this year. So that's something that would be nice to see. But
do they give ranges when they're making these predictions? They say, you know, here on our conservative estimates, it'll be this. On the most optimistic ones, it'll be this.
No.
Why is that good enough to not even give... I don't understand why any of this is good enough. I don't understand why got this. I don't understand why when they give us those numbers... I don't understand why when they say, oh, I'm sorry, this is commercial incompetence. That means we don't have to tell you what it's going to cost you. Bull. Why is the government not powerful enough to say to companies that want to deal with it, hey, look, we answer to the public. We have to show what we're spending on. There is no commercial incompetence with us. Get stuffed. If you want to bid for our jobs, they'll be declared. Like, why is that? Why do we accept this idea of, oh, you can just say, no, don't worry your pretty little heads about it. I get the idea of the government not telling us everything in national security matters to a certain extent, perhaps. But how it's going to spend money, it's negotiations with companies.
And with the budget as well, it's what we, one of the good things is the Parliamentary Budget Office at least does provide a bit of analysis of the budget figures last year. But generally, even there, it's more of a you don't get too much of the precise methodology. You just get their own estimates and essentially their workings. And generally, it's all... it's all basically they plug the numbers into a nice algorithm and they come out with the figures and
that should be released so you guys can try see what happens if you put different numbers. Like, what is this algorithm actually doing? How does the algorithm? It feels like they're pulling a Swiftie.
I wouldn't say they're pulling a Swiftie. I think they are. Because essentially what it is about is not so much the numbers as that precise number is a Swiftie. They're not just making that number up. That's why I look at is what is the basis of those numbers. And the basis of those numbers, you're looking at things like economic growth, inflation, wages growth, employment growth, all of the exports, business investment, because those are the figures that basically they're the ones that they tweak. Because if you increase, if you forecast, for example, that next year wages growth is going to be 3%, and you're going to, once you plug that into the figures and you assume that, okay, we've got 10 million workers or whatever at this average wage, then we'll get X billion dollars in income tax revenue. But if we have wages growth of only 2.5%, then we're going to get less tax revenue. So let's...
On what basis do they pick between those
well, see,
guesses?
That's the thing.
Well,
the basis is the Treasury doing their economic projections. Now, the good thing about those is that they can be... There is enough economists out who look at those figures. Like when the ratings agencies, and for all the badness about the ratings agencies and economists, you know, even people like Chris Richardson and so forth, they don't really come out and go, yeah, I think that revenue figure you've got for that X measure is off. What they'll do is say, yeah, I think your revenue figures are wrong because you're hoping that the economy is going to grow a lot faster than we think it's going to grow. And what I've been doing a lot of work on, because it was the thing that stuck out as soon as I opened up the pages and looked at the projection, is the wages growth.
So what have you found? Are they being in any way realistic?
Well, no. if I'm brutally honest and by, you know, they, because what they're projecting, well, to give the context, yesterday the latest wages growth figures came out showing that wages are growing at 1.9%, which is a record low.
What's the inflation at the moment? What's CPI?
CPI is 2.1.
Okay, so we're all going backwards.
Yeah, so real wages are falling, but wages growth is important because, as I say, how fast your wages grow affects how fast income tax revenue grows, because, you know, if people are getting paid more, then they're going to be paying more tax. So it's a crucial figure in the revenue data. Now, what the government is projecting is that it'll go from 2% this year, so the end of July, end of June, sorry, to be 2%. Then they're expecting it to go to 2.5%, then to 3%, then to 3.5%, and by 2021 it's going to be 3.75%, which would be pretty solid growth. But
and they're basing that on what?
Well, this is where the problems begin, because while you could suggest that might happen, because annual average sort of wages growth of the past, you know, 15 years or so is around 3.5%. That's what you'd expect us to have. So suggesting 3.5% by 2019-20, you'd think, okay, that's fine. But the problem is they're not actually projecting employment growth to really pick up at all. They're not projecting the unemployment rate to fall very much. At best, it gets down to about 5.3%.
Now, let me guess, if you've got a high unemployment rate, that puts a negative pressure on wages.
Yeah, so generally as the unemployment goes down, wages growth goes up. So where we're at the moment, they're essentially hoping that wages growth is going to go upwards while the unemployment rate barely changes, which I just
That's
can't
ridiculous.
See happening. Yeah.
But the other thing is, like, if they're saying, oh, well, look, average growth, wages growth is in around 3%. Well, okay, well, explain why it's 1.9 now and explain what it is that you reckon has magically changed that. And it's going to be all this bloody magical trickle-down thinking, isn't it? It's just going to be, well, we've cut the company tax rate, so therefore, obviously, wages are going to
go. Yeah, pretty much that's it. And that's where that's what they were arguing last year.
But there's no evidence for that. Like,
no, I know.
That's total nonsense.
And that's why, you know, I have written that pretty much those the surplus numbers are, and why others as well, even the ratings agencies basically said they don't really believe the budget will get back to surplus in 2021, because really those figures that get you there are based on a lot of wishing and hoping rather than a lot of reality. So that's why, on one sense, that's what, you know, I look at when I'm in the budget lockup and what I write on. But really, when you get down to it, it's that's whether or not we get back to surplus or not. I kind of find somewhat irrelevant, really. It's more what's within the budget itself. What are the measures? What are actually going to affect people? Things like the cuts to higher education and you know, dopey things such as better target systems to job seekers and things like that.
You've seen the, you know, what the percentage of the welfare budget that's got anything to do with job seekers, and it's tiny, and it's somehow shrinking over time. Like the number of job seekers is going up. Certainly the cost of living is going up, and yet somehow the part of the budget that goes to people who are on Newstart, the dollars are shrinking. It's like, how it just staggers me. I mean, it doesn't stagger me because we'll get to Australia versus Humanity and the stuff that we as a country keep doing to vulnerable people, but who are from overseas, and we do it too. I am staggered that we are letting Newstart fall further and further below subsistence. We say to people, go and get a job and you'll be fine. But A, there aren't enough jobs out there. And B, when somebody on Newstart gets a job, the job doesn't create a job. It's not like an additional, you know, there's one less person who's unemployed. Like that job has got to be filled by somebody. If one person gets it rather than another person, there's still the same number of people who are unemployed.
Well, that's not quite right. It's not like there is a fixed number of jobs in the country.
No, but I mean, saying to some unemployed person, go and find a job. Well, if they get a job, they're not creating a job. The unemployed person doesn't have the power to create a job.
No, but if they get a job, it's not like they take a job from somebody else. It's not a zero-sum game of getting. It's not like one unemployed person getting a job forces someone else into unemployment.
Well, no, but it's not. The number of people who are unemployed, the number of jobs are there, and the number of people who are there to do them, there is a massive shortfall, and you can't get all of it. You can't say to everybody who's unemployed, oh, well, you just need to get ahead of the other unemployed person and then you'll be fine. Well,
oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's I think on average about 4.5 people for every job vacancy. So,
and we're saying to the other ones who don't get the job, oh, well, you can just starve to death. And we're keeping it Newstart so low. Like this, it just gets me. This isn't even a thing that the media even talk about, how low Newstart is. Like, this is a bloody national scandal that we are basically grinding people into poverty so that they are less and less employable as time goes on, because their condition worsens and worsens, and it's harder and harder for them to get work. Like, and then all of the measures in this budget are stick. They're all... You know, if Centrelink says you haven't got a good enough reason for not being at this appointment, and keep in mind Centrelink doesn't give a shit about whether you can afford to get to the appointment or whether you've got, you know, you've got to look after a child, or I mean, Centrelink's very inflexible about these things. You miss it. Oh, well, you can just starve to death. Like, the idea that the government's turning around and threatening people and saying, well, if you don't jump through these hoops, we'll cut you off and you can, I mean, do what? Like, you don't have a buffer if you're on Newstart. You lose your Centrelink and you're kicked out of your home. You can't pay your rent. You can't eat. The idea that this government is actually holding over people's heads, homeless, whether they can have shelter and food, and we're holding these as punishments, things that we'll deny someone if they don't jump through hoops, that is insane. What kind of a country are we? All these measures in this budget that are about kicking the people who are already struggling the most. And by the way, I know that they play really well to the working. It's the people who are just above the people on Newstart on the ladder. Like, for some reason, it works really well psychologically. There's a target audience, you can say. Like, they're the people who really want to hear about how you're kicking the people below them, because they hate the idea that people below them are in any way doing as well as them or close to doing as well as them. They want you lower paid working people are struggling, and they want the people below them to be struggling just a lot more. But the problem is, you make it harder for the people on Newstart. This puts downward pressure on your own wages. The more they kick the people below you, the easier, the more the pressure is on you to cop shitty conditions, because the worse it is for you if you don't accept shitty conditions. Like, it doesn't make any sense to me that people, like, they've somehow got everybody at the bottom fighting with each other while everybody at the top is just sort of, yeah. Anyway, it feels profoundly wrong. And the drug testing thing is further just...
They
won't tell us what it costs either. Well, that's commercially
confidence. The fact that it's a trial, the fact that, you know, it's
only to hurt people, it's to demean
them. Pathetic. Yeah, of course it is. There is no... And there doesn't need to be a trial, given that there have been trials done in other countries and they've all been shown to be useless. And
But they're hoping that this one won't be. They're hoping
hope that. It's like Work for the Dole, you know, that the experience in the UK is that it fails. The experience here has been that it fails, but we've got to give it another trial.
Meat for the base, they say. That coalition backbench was saying Work for the Dole might not work, but it's red meat for the base.
Well, and it's the same with this rather stupid three strikes policy that they've introduced, and this was their big the big stick that they're putting in there, and gave them all these the front page on the Telegraph on Budget Day about, you know, attacking the bludgers and the shirkers.
People at News Corp calling someone who's on Newstart a shirker or a bludger, go fuck yourselves. You're not a bludger because you're temporarily receiving income support because you're unemployed. In a country that had full employment, you know, maybe. But in this country and this economy, no, you're not a bludger because you're on Newstart. And stop calling. And you don't deserve to be forced to undergo invasive drug tests to punish you for daring to... I reckon we need to stop calling it bloody welfare too, because the whole idea of calling it welfare is to imply that it's some kind of, you know, benevolent. It's like the Andrew Bolt thing of, well, these uni students and these people on welfare, they should be thanking us. No, it's called Social Security, and it's a benefit for, it's insurance for all of us, so that we know that if things go wrong, we're not going to starve to death.
Yeah, and I mean the great thing about this three strikes policy is it came about because they believe that there are people who are just doing the bare minimum, as though this is a particularly un-Australian thing that you would do the bare minimum of what the government tells you you need to do to get something. And the suggestion that this is wrong, but then also the penalties are pretty severe given you're starting on such a pathetic level of new start as it is, that, you know, of 530 of for a start. Cutting it by half for a fortnight, then cutting it completely for a fortnight, the second time, then the third time, kicking you off for a month and forcing you to reapply. I mean, that's pretty drastic.
What are they meant to do? Like, what's the person who they've done that to supposed to do? Where does the government suggest that they go? How does the government suggest that they survive?
No, but they don't. They don't believe that. That second order of thinking doesn't come into it. But I mean...
But that's monstrous. Who's making plans like that and going, oh, well, that person can just starve to death. It's not my problem. What? You're the government. That's your policy.
And, of course, it's always pitched as being, well, we've got to do this because the budget's out of control. The amount of welfare we're spending is huge and everything. So,
and they fudge that to make it sound like the welfare is people on Newstart, which is the tiniest proportion and a shrinking proportion of it.
Yeah, I mean the $632 million which this policy expects to save over 5 years would be the equivalent of 0.1% of the entire welfare budget. You know, it's clearly actually got nothing to do with spending. It is all about just being seen to kick people who they think their constituents like to see being kicked. There's nothing, you know, any time you see any minister talking about, you know, such as Christian Porter or Scott Morrison or Matthias Cormann, talking about needing to get welfare under control, if they are not actually mentioning the age pension, basically everything they're saying is largely bullshit, because that is there are two aspects of the welfare social security budget that are growing. It's the age pension, and the second one is disability, and the only reason disability is increasing is because of the introduction of the National Disability Insurance Scheme. So, of course, that's going to be increasing because it's only just started. But really, the one that is growing is the age pension.
And that's going to need to grow more because can you imagine when our generation, or not your generation, it's slightly younger than you, gets to pension age and they don't have houses, they're all paying rent. Can you imagine trying to pay current rent on the pension? Can you imagine trying to pay 20 years from now rent on the pension?
Yeah, so it's... they can't talk about that because one, and I'm not suggesting that they should be cutting the pension at all or anything like that. And certainly all the evidence I've seen suggesting that the welfare budget is out of control is wrong. Even accounting for the increasing in with the aging population is that, it is not growing at a level which is unsustainable. In fact, our pension system and together with the superannuation system basically is one of the best in the world. And whenever you see any minister wanting to talk about the big blowout, they'll generally use some big nominal figure from 2050 that sounds huge because any figure will be huge in 2050. I mean, by 2050, $100,000 will probably be your median wage.
Which at the moment, so the median wage at the moment is something like, what, 40 or 50? It's not much. It's very...
I tried to figure this out from the stats from the
ABS, and all I could find was like median household income, and then divide it by the average number of adults in a household, and I got something like 40, 45.
It is generally when we do talk about medians, the median, my latest sort of calculations of it were just using the taxable income. The median taxable income for people was about $54,000. But it differs if it's men or women. The median for women is about $47,000.
Is that figure, that's for all adults over 18, including people who are unemployed?
That's for everyone who has a taxable income.
Okay, so that's ruling out unemployed people.
Yeah. So that's already
distorting, because if you're trying to get a figure...
Well, I'm talking about, when you talk about people who are actually earning, who've got, a paying wage, even there, 54 is still pretty, a lot lower than what you'll generally hear them talk about, or 80,000 is your average wage. It's a lot lower than the full-time average wage is 80,000, so... which is massively distorted by the higher income. So even if you at least just talk about people working, and of course if you talk about, as soon as you start moving into including people who aren't working, you really have to shift from individuals and talk more about households.
Because it seems to me that if you're like the relevant, it's the important figure that we need to pay more attention to is what figure... are 50% of adults living on that amount or less? Like adults, so because if we're looking at what human beings, not the human beings as economic units and work units and so forth, if we're looking at like what is it that that of all of the adults roaming the streets in Australia, what is the figure that 50% of them are living on less than? And that should include pensioners and people on Newstart, because these are all adult people out there if all of the figures we ever use for income just rule them right out. They just ignore, pretend they don't exist. Then we're massively distorting.
The problem with that is when you're talking about median incomes, you really have to take in household size, because you're talking about, for example, if you've got two people living together in a house, they need more money than a single person living by themselves does to maintain the same standard of living, because there's two people. If you've got a child, you need more money than, again, a single person. So what we generally, and the problem is the data available to allow us to work out that generally only comes out in, it's kind of linked to the census and various things.
Oh my God, the only thing I can find out about the percentiles for household income were like from 2014. Yeah. Find anything more recent than that.
Yeah, 2014 is about the most recent. The most recent, using that figure, the median income for a single person. So a single person in Australia. So talking basically adults, so not including a single kid or, you know, someone who's, but basically a single person, if you're living by yourself, if you've got an income of $45,500, that's pretty much 50%.
Yeah, that's what I came up with, yeah.
But if you're to have that same standard of living as a single person, if you're a couple with two kids, you would need about $95,500. So if you're a household on $95,000, you're two adults, two kids, that is basically the median sort of household size.
There's another story here about the budget, which I hadn't heard before, but this is a bloody Daily Telegraph article from Sunday. They're going to try and go after people who the Centrelink thinks are in a relationship.
Thousands. Yes, I saw that.
This is the Daily Telegraph article. Thousands of couples pretending to be single to claim bigger welfare checks will have to prove they are not in love to keep their entitlements, and they'll need a witness to back their story. From September next year, feuding parents will have to find a third party to back up claims their relationship is over after the Department of Human Services estimated up to 15,000 people. But I love the way News Corp just runs what the department leaks, tells them to run. Like, they just run their figures uncritically. Oh, the Department of Human Services estimates this. No, they don't talk to somebody who might point out that might be bullshit. I'm still staggered at the idea that Centrelink thinks that it's up to them to go and determine who's in a relationship. And so if you're a person who's on Newstart, a single person on Newstart, which is already well below subsistence, you are going backwards on that money already. If you have a relationship with somebody and you both move into a house, if you're in a house with a share, you're in a share house with somebody because you're all trying to desperately to make your pathetically below subsistence level payment go without having to, you know, live in a bush. So you're in a share house. Okay, they don't cut your wage. You sleep with somebody on a couple of nights, you have a relationship with somebody at your house, suddenly Centrelink goes, we're cutting both of your payments. And then, because they do that, Centrelink has the idea that they therefore should get to interrogate people about their romantic relationships. Fuck, that's so insane. Like, I understand, if somebody is receiving income from another person, then of course that's relevant and that should be declared.
Yeah.
But the idea that Centrelink is turning around to people and saying, oh, if you had sex with somebody, then they must start paying for you. They must be supporting you. No, that's not an assumption that's valid. The only question that Centrelink should be asking is, are you getting money from that person? Are you being supported? If you are, yes, that should reduce your payment. If you're sleeping with them, so what? Why are we saying to poor people, I'm sorry, if you did have a partner, we're going to punish you for it financially?
I think it's... Again, one of these occasions where, yes, the actual policy of whether or not you're actually in a relationship with someone is actually, as you say, quite pertinent. And but this sense that, for a start, that, you know, they estimate that up to 15,000. I mean, give me a break. You know, where are they? You know, let's make up any odd number. And for a start, we're talking a minute number of people who would be claiming such benefits. And you're going after people who are on bugger all.
Yeah, it's always kick the people who are starving to bloody, like, it's on the very bottom.
Yeah, they always come up with the example of a woman who was jailed after she claimed single parent.
And they get given it by the department. Like, the department, when they're giving it to the newspaper.
Yeah, but I mean, you know, this is the thing, that the exception doesn't, you know, prove the rule that, you know, oh, well, there was this one person. Well, yes, of course there's this one person, but, you know, then the further dehumanizing of them, of having to prove that, it's, and the, what we're talking here are people who are lying for 7-8 years about, their relationship status. Now that's pretty, severe for a start. But also,
it's pretty onerous.
I've got no problems with someone being fined or you know, if the penalty is jail, if for 8 years they've been claiming benefits that they're not entitled to. And doing so in a clearly fraudulent manner. But what they're after here, it's much like the data matching thing. They're after every single bloody dollar. It's like, oh, this week you said you started being in a relationship, and this week we're out to see if actually you were in that relationship 3 weeks earlier, or you've stopped it 3 weeks later than you. You know, it's that type of thing, which is just.
Which must cost a fortune. It must cost so much more for them to chase up than they're actually even going to gain from those very poor people.
Exactly. And it's not given. You know, we're talking 15,000 people. Give me a break. It's such a small number when you're looking at family tax benefits and single parenting payments. And the amount of money saved is minute and much, you know, as I say, look, the huge thing that they went after for so-called dole bludgers who weren't turning up and doing everything until they were forced to, they're all of that, if all goes well, they're going to cut 0.1% of the Social Security budget. And it's like, really? That's it. To me, it just highlights how much bullshit the whole, oh, there's all these bludgers, there's all these cheaters on the welfare system is. Because when they actually put the numbers in their own budget papers and you actually do the math, you realize, hang on, this is giving you nothing. You know, you're making it sound like this is a big thing that we need to do to keep our budget under control, and it's having bugger all effect. And the reason it's having bugger all effect is there actually aren't many people who are actually abusing the system in this way. It's a very small number, and really what it means is what they're interested in is not the integrity of the system, but the just basically going after people who they think are an easy kick and kicking as hard as they can.
It feels like with the drug thing, they're all about making life miserable for people on Newstart. It's about resentment that they even exist and punishing them. It feels like,
yeah,
the same with the refugees. Like, we will spend a lot more money than we would have ever saved by not paying payments to people. We will spend a fortune hurting the people at the bottom. And yeah, the drug thing, the papers don't even tell us how much it's going to cost to actually run the tests. Compared with the money that this magic figure of $600 million they reckon they'll somehow save, where they pull that from again.
No, why, it's all very opaque.
Why aren't journalists turning around and saying, yeah, no, I'm not publishing. I mean, we'll say the government claims, but it hasn't provided any work. Like, this is the kind of, it's almost like the classic, the way the media had to start dealing with Trump stuff. Like, they really need to, don't your colleagues need to turn around and say, when you put that figure of $600 million, say the government claims it'll save this, but we note that they've not told us how much the drug testing will cost. In other countries, it's cost roughly this much. And there's no basis on which they haven't provided any basis on which they calculate $600 million. Like, every time those figures are repeated.
Well, I mean, I can only speak for my colleagues at The Guardian. We're not exactly unskeptical of government statements, which is probably why we never get the big splash that, hey, look, we're going to be drug testing welfare people. The Treasurer generally doesn't see fit to include us in a hell of a lot, probably because we actually do point out things. You know, I write 3 articles in 1 week saying your budget figures are crap. So, why did the Daily Telegraph do it? I don't know. They seem to think it appeals to their readers. I doubt it does, but, you know.
I see the ABC do it a lot. The ABC just repeat the government number. They'll say, this is going to save 600. I've been staggered at how much. Yeah. So we've got this bullshit line of this being a Labor budget because what? The government finally remembered that, oh, okay, fine. Our original attempt to grind the poor into the dust from 2014, which we just have spent 3 years trying to get through the Senate, we can't get it through. Fine, we give up. We'll raise some revenue. We'll do it in the way that's we'll hit everyone, so the poor and the rich alike, on our Medicare levy. We'll make sure the rich still get the deficit levy off them, so they'll be happy about that. We'll hit the banks, but keep in mind that we've just given everybody a giant bloody tax. Oh no, sorry, the banks haven't got that tax cut yet because it's only for small businesses.
The suggestion actually is that the budget levy actually might cost them more than the tax cut, which surprised me. But I'm not sure whether that's because the budget levy is harder to avoid than company tax. I'm not sure, but
oh my god! So because their figures were wrong on the company tax cut, they'd put it in at the budget of what, 50 million or something, and they're 50 billion, sorry, and now it's 64 billion.
No, that's not wrong.
It was an extra year or something, wasn't it?
Like no. What's happened there is the original 10 years figure of 48. Whatever million
was billion,
from
was it?
Yeah, billion. Sorry, was from July last year, and the latest figure is from July this year. And what that means is it is final year of that 10-year period now includes a year when all companies will have their company tax at 25%. And what
that's
that
$15 billion dollars.
Yeah, what that shows is the astronomical cost that is going to be ongoing. Changing that year, 1 year change, added essentially 30% to the total 10-year cost. So
what's it going to be when you add the year after?
Exactly.
That?
So yeah, exactly. It's going to be something that it just is going to compound in a massive way. And so,
and they're going to turn around then and say, "Oh, we've got a budget deficit. The deficit's getting worse. We've got to kick the poor even harder."
For me, the real story of that, not really a slip, but certainly untidiness by Morrison and Turnbull, wasn't that, oh, there's this budget blowout or anything like that, because it's not. But what it was just really highlighting, this is a huge cut. It is not just a small tinkering. It is a massive cut to the budget. And you got to make that up somewhere. And
well, it's like the deficit we have now. How much of that is... So I went and did my own back-of-the-envelope numbers of trying to figure out what it was that Costello's tax cuts in 2004, 2005 have been costing the budget every year since then. And I get like $50 to $60 billion a year. Does that sound within it's huge. And that's the deficit. If Costello and Howard hadn't done those income tax cuts, we wouldn't be in deficit. We wouldn't have been in deficit the whole time.
No, I wouldn't go that far. We certainly would have gone in. Everyone would have gone into deficit in 2009-10, just by virtue of the collapse in both company tax and the increase in unemployment rose by 1%. But certainly, they were not tax cuts that were timed well, given, and
I'd be curious what figure you'd come out for how much those are, because obviously it's increasing because the raw numbers would increase over time.
Yeah, no, I've never sort of worked them out, and I guess that if you start from the initial ones in 2004, that certainly I think you'd be on better ground if you said we didn't start the tax cuts at all from 2004. I think the last lot, if we kept the last lot that they took to the 2007 election, even if they kept them, I think we still would have gone into deficit forever. How much that even matters?
Maybe not deficit, but in terms of the we wouldn't be in a structural deficit now. Like we would have. I mean, that's
no, certainly that's been the biggest. Yeah, they blew the mining boom on tax cuts. And that was fine if the mining boom kept going. The Australian Institute is suggesting from the tax cuts from 2005 to 2012 cost the budget $170 billion. Now, I assume that's cumulative. And in 2012, they were costing $37.6 billion per year, even accounting for bracket creep. And there were some changes for bracket creep. But even accounting for that, it's $26 billion. So the capital gains tax discount that was brought in 99, that's worth about $5.8 billion per year.
Well, and also the destroying the housing market.
Yeah, destroyed the housing market, a nice little, I would almost suggest intended consequence.
Oh, my God, that housing, the lamest, Morrison's standing up there and saying, we're going to do something about housing affordability. And that's his policy. He's half-assed some people will be able to use put $30,000 extra into their super if they've got enough that they can put aside, as young people paying modern rent. Even if they could put that aside, that would just inflate prices. Like, it's just insane.
Yeah.
They don't.
Yeah, it's a nothing, and it was clear, just from the language that was said earlier on in March, and where they were really talking up housing affordability as a big ticket item in the budget, and what was delivered in that, there must have been some fairly strong pushback against other things, because it was just a nothing.
Really, this generation needs to start eating boomers. I think it's just getting ridiculous. Did you see the one the 40-year-old who was talking about how young people are just spending too much on $4 coffees, and some dickhead who'd got rich off. He'd been given a gym to renovate or something, and he'd sold that and made 12,000 profit or something on that. And then his grandfather gave him 34,000, and then he used that to get into property in 2001. I'm sure any millennial would love you to give them $34,000 and, you know, a time machine to travel back to 2001. They wouldn't be whinging about being unable to get into the housing market then.
Well, it always seems with these investors that the key strategy is always to be born to parents by parents who actually can afford to give you, you know, 30 grand to get started. That seems to be the primary skill involved. Before the housing market went mad.
I was able to work and save up and buy a house in 2005, came out of the market for various reasons. And don't have that money now. Can't get back in now, and I'm on a much better salary than I was at the time. Like, I can personally attest that it is a profoundly different system. Mm. 2005, you could still do it in Melbourne. Now, you can't. And you've got all these people being like, oh, well, young people should just go and live in the country. Well, actually, this leads us neatly on to what I believe is Denise's Stuck in My Craw.
Hello again, well may we sayers. It's Denise back with what's stuck in my craw this week. And surprisingly, to some, it's again housing. This week on Twitter and a few other platforms, I've run into people making the comment, why don't you just move if you can't afford the house prices in Sydney or in Melbourne? As if this is just the easy solution that none of us had ever thought of. A lot of people have responded with, well, my job is here. The response is, well, there's jobs everywhere. You can just go somewhere else and get a job without any consideration of length of service, industries being specific, perhaps not exactly finding the same sort of job in other areas. I know I've recently moved from Sydney to Melbourne, and because of that, my pay rate is going to drop about $10,000 to $15,000 a year for the same work. On top of that, there's a whole bunch of other issues. The people's support networks, their families, their friends, the fact that they like the area that they live in and that they've created a life there. And mostly, it's the worst sort of derailing conversation in the world. It's saying, well, it's all on you. You could just go somewhere else and then you could find a house. I did it. I moved up the Central Coast and I found a place, you know, 10 years ago or 5 years ago, without actually addressing the issues, without addressing the issues of the housing shortfall, the broken market, the fact that it is just really hard to afford a house. And also, that not everyone's portable. Especially, you have to be in a certain position of privilege to have a certain education and a professional career to be able to move and find a job somewhere else. If you have a young family, you're probably not going to be able to find the funds to do that. Or if you work in a job that isn't as well paid or isn't as highly skilled, that's completely off the books for you. What can we do about it? Again, the same sorts of things. Keep writing to MPs, keep writing to your government and talk to them about the issues and how you see them and why this bothers you. And mostly when people say, well, why don't you just move? Speak up and tell them exactly why you don't and why they're actually not helping the conversation at all. And that is what's stuck in my craw.
I'd say I love the excuse that boomers give for them owning all the property and pushing young people out of, oh, well, you know, you guys don't need to live in Sydney and Melbourne. Like, we got to live in Sydney and Melbourne. These cities have been here for a long time. And, you know, our parents didn't price us out of these cities, but we've just priced you out. You know, it's just the way things are now. Just live with it. As opposed to the rest of us turning around and saying, no, get stuffed. You were able to live in Sydney. we should be able to live in Sydney the same way. You shouldn't have broken it so that you're the last people who are allowed to live here. And also, are you sure that you really want to live in a city that has no young people able to look after you in your decrepitude?
Yeah, I think that's pretty much right. I mean, it's actually ties in with the whole attack on the unemployed and the sense that it really is their fault and you need to almost be punished for not having a house, in the same way that you need to be punished for not having a job. And that punishment is you should go live somewhere where we don't live. Because most of the calls that would suggest, oh, just, you know, go move to the country or move to Adelaide. Now I'm from Adelaide or from South Australia. And the reality is that plenty of people would love to live in Adelaide with the housing prices in Adelaide that you can get that are, you know, much, much cheaper than Sydney. But the jobs aren't there, and there's a reason Adelaide is a smaller city than Sydney and Melbourne, and that's because the jobs aren't there and because they don't have the history of the families and population that are in Sydney and Melbourne, and people stay close to home generally, because as I said, the support networks, there is a cost for moving. It's certainly something my family, we've certainly noticed, because our families are both in South Australia, and so when we were here in Canberra with two young kids, we'd look on with envy at friends who, oh, they're just dropping the kids off at their parents for, you know, Friday night and out they go and things like that, whereas for us it was, you know, that option's not available, or having someone to come over and help out and things like that. And so there is actually a cost involved in moving to somewhere, not only just in terms of employment, but in other social matters. And it's just a bizarre argument, this sense of you don't have a house here, the housing market has been distorted, and the solution is that you should leave. That's a bizarre solution, a bizarre suggestion. And
I think we should treat it with the contempt it deserves.
Well, I think so. And but the problem is, when, and it's at a small level, but the problem, and I guess I feel it because of being an ex-public servant and living in Canberra, is when the government starts actually trying to make a policy and starts trying to forcibly move government departments and government branches of departments, you know, out to Armidale and to other areas in regions, and doing it for purely political reasons, and then laughably suggesting, oh, this will be good for housing and so forth, and doing so despite cost-benefit analysis showing it is an utterly stupid move, both in terms of policy and just in terms of budgetary cost. So it's that combination which is always a bit, I think, annoying to see. But really, I think it's just that nice cousin of the bash the unemployed. It's the bash the non-homeowners. It's your fault.
The people who you've screwed over, you turn around and try and make them feel that it's their fault. They shouldn't dare ask for better. They shouldn't dare push back against, you know, what are basically robber barons screwing them. By the way, and I also love the thing of you should just move to the country after these people voted in the Libs who just destroyed the NBN. Like, there may have been a whole bunch of regional jobs that would have been able to grow if we had a decent NBN and not the shambles that Malcolm's left us with. And in the budget, well, back to the budget, has added this little tax too. Did you say that you've seen the new the NBN tax that Malcolm's adding to add insult to injury?
Oh, actually, no, I haven't noticed that one. Which one's that?
So they're proposing to put a $7.10 levy on ISPs that are connected to the NBN, which will then get passed on.
Passed on to us, yes.
and to, it's in order to try and fund the shambles of the mix that they've set up. But it's, I mean, we're now paying so much more for this thing that Malcolm has broken. Anyway, it's just one of the, for them to then be saying, yeah, why don't you move out of the country? Well, I don't know. We had an option of doing that, and then you guys ruined the ability, ruined this excellent plan that would have given this, that would have actually encouraged growth in the region. It's not an $8 billion bloody rail line for grain. A proper NBN in the regions would have enabled telecommunications. It would have been so much many businesses could have sprung up around the country unfettered by whether you're tethered to Melbourne or Sydney, and these bastards came in and wrecked it. And the thing that staggered me most about it is that the Nationals supported this wrecking of the old scheme, so that you end up with this, because the Labor model was one where everyone around the country had the same access and paid the same. So city people were effectively subsidising the country, really. And the coalition model is one which is more people in the city get better access and people in the country get shit. And the Nationals voted for that because they're much more interested in having ministry positions with the Libs than they are in representing country voters. But I don't know why country voters keep voting for the Nats if they do that sort of stuff. Anyway, it's galling. Can I ask you, Greg? At the end of all of that, like this, how out am I on this? It feels to me like this is a budget that is only Labor light to the extent that they realised that they had to raise some revenue. And they didn't do it in a very progressive way, but they did realise that, okay, we cannot squeeze our way back to budget surplus because, frankly, look, we've tried shoving the poor into those sort of machines that you saw in the, you know, in the wall, another brick in the wall, and the kids fall into that thing. We tried putting the poor into one of those things, but we couldn't get enough money out of it. Okay, fine. We'll try and hit middle income earners a bit more and pay for it that way, which isn't really all very Labor-like when you've got brutal measures persecuting the unemployed. You've got the real money going back, the corporate tax cuts and the loss of the budget deficit levy, which are entirely benefiting the people at the top. And those are the huge budget measures that... We're not really funding the NDIS with our levy. We're not really funding Gonski or their version of it. It doesn't feel like we're actually funding any of those things. What it actually feels like is we're funding those revenue cuts that they've brought in.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. It's you take away the company tax cuts and you don't need to raise the Medicare levy. And I've got no problems with the Medicare levy being raised. I mean, and Labor certainly did do it.
Although they wanted to only apply it to people on 87 and 1,000.
Yeah, but I'm saying Labor did, they raised it from 1.5 to 2%. So I don't have a great problem with that.
I like how they report that in the Oz too. They call it, if you're raising it from 2 to 2.5%, which is it's an increase of a 0.5 of a percentage point. Hmm. But they refer to that as a 25% increase because, of course, 0.5 is 25% of 2. So they call it a 25% increase, which makes that 0.5 sound huge. But if you reduce the company tax rate from 30 down to 25, which is 5 percentage points, they call it a 5 percentage point drop. They don't call it a 17% drop. Weird, that.
Yeah. So, I think you're right. It's... basically, the focus on revenue being increased, which was just such an about face over what they'd been saying for 3, 4, 5 years about, governments needing to cut spending. They're not getting back to surplus by cutting spending.
And the good debt, the thing that they finally realised that there's a difference between debt for infrastructure.
So on the real big picture budget numbers, there certainly was that light Labor aspect to it.
Only in the sense that they didn't try to go hardcore Joe Hockey. It wasn't very Laborish. It just wasn't Joe Hockey. No. It was like in the middle.
Yeah, and I think it's perhaps somewhat a testament to where the Labor Party has found itself, that such a budget could actually even get by as being called Labor light.
And apparently any kind of revenue is now Labor light.
Yeah, I think so. There's something in that about what does that suggest? Not so much about this budget, but what people think a Labor budget actually is. or would be.
I was listening to the Sky Agenda thing, and Paul Kelly is determined to believe that this is some kind of a giant lurch to the left. Australia is lurching to the left. It's just, what?
It's become a bit of a thing that, for example, that Shorten's suggesting that, the Medicare levy only cut in at 87,000 is somehow this very, that Labor should have played smart and taken the money and run, and instead they made it this great mistake by
giving a damn about people on under 85, 87.
Yeah, being somewhat socialist or something, which just seems bizarre for me.
Class warfare. Paul Kelly kept talking about class warfare and redistribution.
Well, I mean, if a Labor budget reply speech doesn't provoke the Oz saying class warfare, then you've fallen at the first hurdle, really. So,
He's very excited by Paul. Apparently, Paul Keating came out and said that the top marginal rate should never be more than 39% or something. And, like, Keating, of course, being the person who cut the tax rates down in the first place in the 80s from, I think they were like at 60, 67 or something at that one point back. They've certainly been a lot higher than they are now.
Yeah.
And the Aussies, like, if we ever have a tax rate that's over 50, Putin's face will be on everything. But, I mean, for God's sake, we had that for the 70s and 80s. Like, they're really hoping that people don't have the faintest sense of actual history in Australia at all. Like, we have had tax rates much higher than that, and it was not communism.
Hmm. And certainly a tax rate of 49.5%, the top tax rate of 49% is certainly, we can cope with that. I don't think it's particularly harsh. And but again, it's pretty much all the conservative press have to hang their hat on, because they were really pissed off with the budget. They really did not like Morrison actually acknowledging there was a revenue problem.
It's been astonishing reading the Oz editorial every time they talk about budget repair and the deficit. Like, they're saying, well, the only option is spending cuts. There's, you know, either you're leaving the deficit there or you've got to cut spending on the very poor. And you're like, no, there's a really obvious other thing you could do. We can all see it. Just pretend. It's like the emperor's clothes. It's like, we can see that it is there. You're pretending that it doesn't exist. It's just been staggering that they've run that so long. I guess there are people out there who take the, you know, read the Oz for information, and they must believe it. Like, people buy it. I mean, not many. I mean, okay, mainly they're just picking it up in airports, but still.
They have their philosophies.
Their philosophy anything more than, we just want tax cuts for the rich, and look, you can have to fund those by kicking the poor in the face?
Pretty much.
I mean, I'd love there to be some more sophistication to it, but it does seem to be pretty much tax cuts for rich people, good. Anything that helps poor people, bad.
It's just that real Puritan aspect of, poor people have clearly done something wrong to end up in that position. And it's behind a lot, it's behind so much of it. It's that there needs to be a punishment for being poor, for not having saved up enough to buy a house when you were 10.
Stupid young people being not having the sense to be born to wealthy parents. Mm-hmm. I mean, goodness. I love whenever the Oz talks about it, because they've got another big B in their bottom. Paul Kelly was doing this to Chris Bowen as well. He's like, you want to spend more money on education, but all the evidence shows that, we've been spending more on education and it hasn't been increasing results. Like, the Oz seriously tries to argue that putting money into public education won't improve results. Does anybody at the Oz not send their child to a very expensive private school?
And the problem with education spending, of course, is that if you have poor spending, as I think everyone agrees we had under the Howard model that Labor kept for far too long, that takes any new spending changes, such as the Labor brought in with their Gonski funding, takes ages to actually lead to anything. I mean,
yeah, because it takes time to build the facilities and employ the teachers and.
Yeah, and it takes time for a kid to actually go through school. You know?
That's true.
I mean,
we've had Ponsky for 2 years, and the children have not all immediately replaced their entire educational background.
Yeah, it's almost ludicrous to suggest, oh, we had Gonski came in when I was in year 9, and that produced all these, you know, 3 years later, look how many great year 12 students we had. You know, that's not how it kind of works. And so no one has ever suggested that all we need is more money, but the problem is that Howard gave them more money badly, and they've been able to use that argument as, oh, see, we gave more money and it hasn't led to anything. And rather than suggesting, well, how about we give them more money but actually spend it more wisely? And that's, I guess that type of logic is just beyond some people, I guess. So anyway.
Talking of logic that's beyond people, Australia versus Humanity. Now, I've started just, whenever these horrific things come up, I'm just, from the Well May We Say Twitter account, I'm just retweeting them with hashtag Australia versus Humanity, because it's just so we can keep track of the horrors. But this week's had quite a few. Did you see that? So the detainees on Manus Island are being told that they can. Basically, they're being threatened with jail. They're being told that they can go to Cambodia. They can go into the community. Well, sorry, the ones who have been approved as refugees can go into the PNG community that don't want them there, and you know where they were recently attacked. And there was also evidence this week that Dutton was just absolute, and the department were absolutely lying about when they were claiming that the PNG Navy only fired into the air the other week. You know that bit when they raided the.
Yeah,
it was a Good Friday, I think, wasn't it?
Yeah,
and they shot. There are bullet holes in the walls. Like they were being shot towards where the detainees and staff were. It's horrific. And then we're telling them that they've got to either go to the community that's where they're not safe. They've got to or go to Cambodia or go back to the country that they've fled from.
Mm-hmm.
There will be no. You need to consider your options. No one will be resettled in Australia.
It's a classic government, though. They're like, hey, you always said you wanted Manus Island camps closed. Well, we're closing them. It's like, that's not quite what we meant. You know? There's a difference between closing the camps and actually, you know, settling them in Australia or actually treating them humanely and just say, well, we're closed the camps, and they could go fuck themselves, really. I mean, it's...
Well, that's exactly God. Right. They are. Like, yeah. The other thing that leaked out this that your paper released yesterday was a plan that leaked from early 2016, which outlined how the department was going to coerce those recognised as refugees into leaving the detention centre and accepting resettlement in PNG while pushing the asylum seekers to abandon their claims and return home. And they were separating out the refugees from those people who hadn't been recognised, and basically... Okay, it says this is the proposal. Rationale. I'm reading off what the document is. The basis for this proposal relates to the identified intent. 1, conditions and entitlements should become more attractive as asylum seekers move through the process. 2, conditions and entitlements should become more attractive as refugees move towards a settlement outcome. 3, conditions for refugees at the East Lurengau Refugee Transit Centre should be more attractive than for refugees at the Lombrum RPC. 4, conditions for refugees at the RPC should be more attractive than conditions for transferees. 5, conditions for transfers should be more attractive than conditions for non-refugees. To affect this outcome, each cohort would require a different level of service provision. To achieve that, the most practical approach is to reorganise the RPC into a facility that caters for cohorts as described. So they do things like they move the transferees to the western end of the detention centre because it does not have air conditioning. Like, there's this whole list of things that they were doing specifically to make life miserable as possible for these very vulnerable people. Like, there is a government department funded by us as taxpayers that was finding ways to bully and treat badly refugees. Not this bullshit about that we're just keeping them in you know, civilized facilities and not processing. You know, it's pure bastardry. It's monstrous.
Yeah, and I mean, that was an excellent report by Ben Doherty and others, and you can I guess, sort of plugging Guardian here, but you could certainly do worse than go to Guardian and look up all the articles written by Ben Doherty. He won the Walkley for his coverage of asylum seekers last year, and he just does some fabulous reporting on the absolute shit that is going on in the detention centres. And this one was just... It's one of those ones where you would expect to read such a thing in a fairly nihilistic satire, but that it's at the point where they are actually implementing it as policy to basically make life as shit as possible for these people.
Deliberately, to
the point where they're doing risk assessment on doing these, and you know, it's just horrendous, and it.
Well, I mean, the Guardian got they got incident reports showing that in 1 week recently, 16 self harm and suicide attempts were recorded by the centre.
Yeah, and you can understand why. I mean, when you have a department that clearly does not view these people as people, I think there's just been a complete breakdown in humanity, I think, from the Department for Immigration, from the Australian government as
we need to burn the department to the ground. The department needs to be dismantled, and then we need to start again with something that's completely unrelated to that mob. Like, aren't they about to get this something like $250 million or something ludicrously expensive fit out of in Canberra, which the government doesn't even have any explanation for that either. It was an insane amount of money they're about to spend on this. It's basically its own, you know, paramilitary kingdom.
It's an awful department with staff who, for the most part, I won't say everyone who's good has left, but it's something, if you stuck around, you've had to swallow a fair bit. Their attitudes towards secrecy, their attitudes towards information to the media, the way they treat the media.
And the compliant way the News Corp media in particular just repeat Dutton's bullshit. Like, the one that came out this week was that Dutton had failed in the tribunal to deport six refugees, that people had the visas, but they had, according to Dutton, they went home for a holiday.
Hmm.
Well, you know what? I don't actually believe a word Dutton says now. The media just play that straight, but then it doesn't explain, and that includes the ABC was playing it straight, and Dutton was blaming politics. But it doesn't in any way explain, that story from the ABC does not explain what the reasoning of the AAT was. Like, you're left as the reader, given one explanation, which is Dutton making this ridiculous claim that they went back to Iran, I think it was, for a holiday. And you don't, and then you're like, well, hang on, that doesn't really make any sense. So what was the basis of the AAT's reasoning? And you don't find out. The media just give Dutton's version and then let it go.
It is a terrible department. It is a terrible policy. There's masses of evidence that it is causing harm, that it is inducing people to harm themselves.
And being harmed by guards. Like, there was the report.
And being harmed by guards. It is what happens when you, as I said a few years ago, this is what happens when you outsource your soul to another nation. And that's essentially what we've done. We've put it out in Papua New Guinea and Nauru and spend obscene amounts of money and spend it in a cruel manner. This is the end result. This is what happens.
This bit here, there's a story from The Guardian this week. So they've got there's a thing called the Chowka Confinement Section, which is on Manus Island. It's a series of shipping containers arranged as an isolation unit about 400 metres from the rest of the detention centre, which is supposed to be closed after consistent reports of violence and inhumane treatment. One of the documents that came out this week, quote, While in Charka, X was instructed to sit on the dirt floor. When his brother was carried in 15 minutes later, X thought he was dead and became agitated. The security guards reportedly responded by bashing and pushing X, tearing his shirt in the process. X was reportedly then forced to the floor and his hands tied tight behind his back, which hurt his shoulder and still causes pain. Around 1500 hours, X, having had a brace placed around his neck, was brought to IHMS with his brother. Indications from IHMS are that the X's wrenched shoulder is an injury consistent with having been restrained. There's another one during unrest. One of the detainees was removed from his room in Delta Compound by Wilson security officers, beaten in the chest. Whilst being removed, a female officer reportedly commented, "Africans, they deserve to be treated like this. They deserve to be finished." Other people heard Australian security staff instructing PNG officers to beat the asylum seekers. And of course, Matt Dutton will just deny any of that stuff. But the problem is, you don't get the credit, the benefit of the doubt, Dutton, when you won't let there be any oversight. Why should we give you the benefit of the doubt? You won't let anybody check.
You only get the benefit of the doubt when you also allow transparency as a government. And the Department of Immigration has taken a stance against transparency. And as a result, I agree that nothing they say should be taken on face value. It should always be applied with a very critical filter.
Yeah, they've repeatedly demonstrated they're happy to lie.
Yeah. And so it's just a continually awful situation that gets worse the more information that comes out about it.
So of the 800 men being moved around in PNG now, so 700 of them have been formally recognised refugees. The other have had their claims denied or still being assessed or appealed. Australia said to them that we will give you $20,000 if you abandon your claims and go home. Otherwise, after August 30, then we'll kick you out anyway, but we won't give you a cent. No idea what's happening to any of them going to the US, but then again, after the, what's her name, Betty Shelby, or whatever her name is, the cop who shot the murder trial, it was only a manslaughter trial in Tulsa, today, did you see that?
No, I didn't see that.
Large African-American gentleman shot with his hands up by a female cop. She was acquitted today by a jury. The footage shows him being shot. I don't even know how they... I mean, the right-wing media are claiming he reached into his car, but the cops could see that the car was shut, the window was shut. He couldn't reach into his car for anything. And the footage doesn't. Anyway, it's just mad. But anyway, if I were a refugee in PNG, I'd be a bit worried about going there at the moment. But the other part of it is, did you see this the threat that we've put to them? So they're going to be violently moved. They're going to be forcibly moved to other facilities. And the official message on Monday carried this thinly veiled threat about daring to oppose the movement. Remember that resettlement countries always consider a person's history of behaviour before reconsidering them for resettlement, including both good and bad behaviour. Disruptive or illegal behaviour could exclude you from resettlement. So don't you dare resist. If you resist, it will somehow get worse for you.
Yeah. No, it's an awful situation, and you can see the government is going to claim that, well, we've closed the Manus Island Detention Centre.
Yeah. Where are those people?
Yeah. And, yeah, it's... some will be transferred to other camps. But at this point, you know, the government doesn't... They don't care.
It's like with kicking people on Newstart. Yeah. We've got a bunch of asshole Australians out there who want... people in Newstart, refugees, to be kicked hard, and they will cheer on the government for doing it. And I don't know, Greg, have you got any ideas how do you change? Because the government's both leading and being led by this hideous attitude where hurting refugees is for some reason satisfying to people. It's not just it's a problem, we've got to deal with it somehow. People actually want to see them being hurt. It's monstrous. But I don't know how, because I don't know any people who have that view. How do you talk to people who are convinced? I mean, It's probably the bloody Daily Telegraph, a large part of it. They keep constantly telling everybody that these people are out here scamming us.
Well, the main way you counter it is by having personal experience with those people, and that is why the government is so desperate for there to be no ability for that to occur. As soon as you have, because people always, even if they still hold the view that asylum seekers are bad or something, that they'll like the asylum seeker that perhaps lives on their street or they know at work or something, they'll be, but he was one of the good ones. But when you deny the ability for them to have a role in the community by keeping them out of the very country, that's the way you do it, and that stops that ability to really, make the calls, because people are like, well, there's almost this sense of, well, why is it our problem? They're not even in Australia. They're in Papua New Guinea. They're in Nauru. That's, their government should be taking care of them.
So what you're suggesting is that it might be beyond the power of this podcast to,
I think so,
actually change those minds. I mean, I'm sure a lot of the people who are adamantly opposed to basically decent treatment for refugees, I'm sure they're listening to this podcast. It's infuriating. I just don't, I could not vote for either of those parties now. Like, no matter what the economic impact was on me, even if they had great, I mean, obviously the Libs have just put down a budget which just makes the problem worse, is based on bullshit optimistic assumptions, even on their own, even the aim that they're trying to achieve, and hurts vulnerable people in Australia. But even if it wasn't for that, like, how do you vote for a party that's doing that? I just can't, that those 700, 800 men on Manus now left with the knowing that our government on our behalf is saying to them, you can take some money and go back to be killed, go back to your country and hope, try and survive, or we'll kick you back there anyway. Or we'll throw you out into this community where you've got no rights, no supports, and the locals want to kill you. Like, the government just doesn't care. Well, it's same with the thing of Newstart that doesn't, when it says we're going to kick people out of off Newstart, to do what? Like, they don't have a backup. They don't care. To die. How is it that we've accepted this as a government? That this is that we, I had always thought that there was a bottom line. You're not going to die. There was a safety net. We're not going to throw people out to die. Like, at this point, we're saying to somebody on Newstart, well, you can starve to death. I suppose if you committed a crime, you can go to prison. You'd be fed there.
You always keep waiting for that moment when perhaps, especially on Newstart, you think that surely we've reached a point where people realise that it's got so low that it's impossible to subsist on it. But Labor keep pretty much just saying, oh, we'll look at it. But I think they really need to be bold. And if they really want to push the progressive side of things, I think they've got to worry about not just people who are working and ensuring that they get a living wage for actual work, but also for those who are out of a job, and what having a level of new start that we currently have, what that actually means for people's lives. And it would be nice to see them go to the next election at least propose an increase on it, because I think it'd be a fairly easy sell. It's something that many sides of many businesses, business groups have even sort of suggested, that it's got to the point now that it means that people who are unemployed are, if you're unemployed for very long, you quickly become unemployable because you just aren't able to keep up your skills and essentially be able to be in a job ready state of being when you're just worried about surviving. So that would certainly be something I'd recommend that Labor parties do.
I'd like to see it too. That's probably a good place to wrap it up. Welcome to all of our new listeners. people who've been tempted on by the presence of Greg. Thank you to those of you who've come back. Thank you to everyone who's promoted us on Twitter. Huge thanks to all of our Patreon subscribers and anyone who has given us or will give us a 5-star review on iTunes so other people can find us. Thank you to my co-host for tonight, Greg Jericho. Thank you, Greg.
Thank you. Pleasure.
Thank you, our Stuck in My Craw contributor, Denise Pierco, our beloved editor, Daniel Karma, Robin Gray for the music, and Alex Lum for the artwork. And we look forward to seeing you all now. Maybe not exactly next week. I may be somewhere else with some news. But very soon. We'll be back very, very soon. But and as will Greg. You'll come back and do Stuck in My Craw?
I will.
Okay. All right. Well, we'll see you all soon. Good night, Australia.
Night.